Hi, I'm John Street Capital. I'm panicked about Howard.
Boys Day on Panic with Friends.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
We've got Don Nitti from the movie. What movie was the Nitti family? What, that's one of the great movies.
The Enforcer.
No.
Al Capone. He was the
Yeah,
hitman.
But what was the name of the movie?
With the Untouchables?
Yeah, The Untouchables.
Yeah.
So Don Nitti, hedge fund guy, has been on my pod. Obviously now a big part of Social Leverage as we move forward and grow. It's full disclosure. We have four funds. Don and I have known each other forever. He cold called me. Did you cold call me?
I cold called you, and then I pitched you a chicken stock.
No way.
Yeah, Pilgrim's Pride. I told you that the chicken prices were going up because McDonald's was hoarding everything in cold storage.
That's so funny. So Don is legendary in my book because I've never bought one of his ideas in 10 years, and now he's working for me. And all of them are good. Like, by the way, He's still cold calling people. He works for us. He still cold calls people and pitches stocks. I go, dude, we have a fund. You don't need to pitch Pilgrim Pride. And so we're excited. No one knows markets. There's a lot of people that know markets. Don's up there. You know, there's thousands of people, the 1% that just live and breathe this shit. But Don also is a crossover guy, and we're fascinated by that. And so we're so excited to have him. I don't let him on the pod often because I just blabber, but this is a special day because we have a repeat guest, John Street Capital. He's anonymous, but we know him. We have drinks with him. I would say top five smartest people I know. Do you remember his first podcast with us?
I do, yeah.
Especially for his age. I think he's in his 20s. He may be in his teens because he's anonymous. Don, would you say he's in his 30s?
I think mid-30s.
Mid-30s. But he's the wisdom of a 6-year-old. Yeah, super thoughtful. Everybody should go back and read him. I discovered him through Rob Petroza, who's going to be on the podcast soon too. Rob from Rally Road. Rob was, we just happened to be at co-investors. And like I said, he's a real person because we co-invest and he has a real job. He just prefers to stay anonymous. And I just watched the Geffen thing, and I'm like, I'd like to be his agent. So I just hate that he's anonymous. Have you met him, Don?
I have.
Yeah. We all went out.
We had drinks in the Seaport, and then you told me last time you saw him when you were in New York that he packed on some weight. You said he was swole. Came in a medium T-shirt.
Yeah, he's swole. He's like 280. Oh, you mean packed like Roger Ehrenberg?
No, he's like jacked. Yeah, he's working out every day.
Yeah, he's on Jeff Bezos. He got Jeff Bezos. They're on group text. So we can say anything about him because he's fucking anonymous. He could be 600 pounds. He could be 11. He could be a Filipino. He could be a Swahili. We don't know. He's definitely not Norwegian.
Okay.
Because he's smart.
Oh, yeah. Not Swedish either.
Yeah. And he's anti-oil. So I don't even tell him you're from.
No, I won't. I won't.
So we have so much to talk about. First go around, we see eye to eye, which bugs me because I just think he's being a nice guy because he's much smarter than me. But what makes John Street unique is that he understands infrastructure and technology and banking and corp dev and VC and trading. And I play one on a podcast. He actually does it in real life. So you have to trust me on that. Would you say the same, Don?
Yeah, I mean, just through and through, he knows, everything cold that he's talking about.
Yeah, and he's married, no kids. I know that because I know his wife. And what else can I tell you about him? He's 4'8", which I think is probably why he wants to stay anonymous. It's almost like a Keebler. The only person I know who's shorter is Sheil, and we had a clubhouse together, the three of us. It's just I couldn't deal with it because I was so tall, even on a podcast. If John Street was half an insurer, they would say he has, what do you call him? Not a midget. What's the proper term for it?
I think he's a small person, though.
Yeah, he'd have Calcanis arms. That Calcanis has an arm that's kind of like a midget. And so anyways, with that intro, he's going to want to become anonymous anymore, so I can't spread lies about his appearance. But he chose this life. Let's welcome John Street Capital to the pod.
Hey, Howard, how's it going?
Good. Don't listen to that opening.
Yeah, I tend not to. So it shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, it was very short and very brief, and we said nothing about you.
Perfect.
The Don's on the phone. You know Don.
Hey, Don, what's going on?
How's it going?
Social leverage is expanding. Don has a million questions, as do I. So we want to start with, you said you're panicked about Howard. You have a great sense of humor. What is it, my cholesterol that bothers you, or are you really just like scared of being on the show? Are you worried about me?
Well, you're having a lot of liquidity events recently. So between eToro and Robinhood and some other portfolio companies, I just don't know where that capital is going to get recycled into. So that's what I'm panicked about.
AMC.
That makes sense.
Pilgrim Pride, GME. Well, that's why we're here to talk about free advice. Why hire an advisor if I got you two schmendricks? So let's talk about that first. Liquidity, private and public markets. This is the area that, and I didn't prep you for this, but let's get your takes on this. We both are crossover people. We invest in private, late stage, public, venture, you name it. You have more experience than me. But this last 6 months, I call it like the Jaws moment where the sharks are in the water and I can see the end zone. But I'm like, you know, whatever. I'm not going to be poor if everything went to zero, but it's like close to big numbers. We have to solve that in fintech. We all watched The Big Short and swaps and this and that. I'm happiest with the biggest discount right now for a certain percentage of my portfolio just because I'm so close to the goal line. Is that a big market to be solved, John Street?
The close to retirement market?
No, the close to, like, I'm almost liquid, but like I don't want any catastrophe insurance. Like, how do I, taking some money off the table, this stupid 6 month rule, these companies going public too late and employees having all this extra stress because they're not quite rich, even though they sound rich on paper.
No, absolutely. I think that is a really big market. I mean, you're obviously an investor in a company called SecFi, which is doing this at all stages. I've looked at some companies that are exploring exchange funds, which are really interesting because not only do you get to take some money off the table, you get to diversify and you get to defer any taxes. So I think that's a big market opportunity that we're just starting to see happen because the exit sizes are getting so much larger.
Correct. It's because of the TAM. So what does an exchange fund do? So I think I've been pitched a few. And have you invested in one or are you just been pitched?
I haven't invested in one yet. I think they're still a little bit nascent getting off the ground. But an exchange fund is a swap fund. So they exist in the public markets predominantly, where concentrated shareholders of companies can pool shares for a diversified pool of securities in exchange for that, and you defer taxes. So it's not a taxable event. So say you're a founder of a big tech company, you have all your net worth tied up in that stock. You don't want to sell it, but you want to diversify your risk. That was sort of the impetus for exchange funds.
So they trade as public tickers? That's genius.
So not for private company exposure right now. Those are all public.
No, but
company,
you can do it. There's like public things that I could buy, or they're really just swaps that are not public, but it's a great way for a C. That's genius.
Yeah, it's a really elegant structure, particularly from a tax perspective. You'll have daily liquidity. And if you think about it from a private market standpoint, you end up owning a diversified pool of unicorn startups, right? And you can structure in such a way where if you wanted after a certain point of time to get an in-kind distribution, right, you ended up being a Robinhood investor and that had a much larger outcome than any of your other bets, you know, you could actually get those shares back at the end of the life. So there's some really elegant structuring going on. But I think as exit sizes get larger, you know, it's no longer just the C-suite and the largest equity investors that are having these sort of generational wealth paydays. You went from 10 employees to 100 employees to 1,000 employees now that are having 7-8-figure paydays, which means this market opportunity is growing really rapidly.
Right, which is why we did SecFi a few years ago, and you know some of the other investors. So we're thinking alike there. Don, any thoughts there? Because you were on the public side of this and helping do swaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think for, you know, what you're seeing now, you know, it's almost like you go back 7 years, 6 years ago, you know, no hedge funds were really involved in these crossover. And now every single hedge fund out there is now a crossover fund. And you even see later stage growth funds becoming hedge funds. So there is more ample liquidity now than I think we've seen in the past for early employees and VCs. But, you know, the surprising thing to me is that it's still a super draconian process. You know, you have to go in, you have to set a price, you have to then go through the ROFR process. People have gotten more creative in the sense that you could transfer stock into a SPV and then sell that SPV off to a fund or another purchaser. But, you know, the tech isn't there yet, and I'm still waiting for someone to solve that problem.
Yes. So that's a big VC market. I think there's AngelList, there's SecFi, there's Carta thinking about this, and there's a lot of hedge funds that do this one-off type stuff. So I think John Street makes the big point here. It's all because of the market cap explosion. We're not talking about nickels and dimes anymore. We're talking about bedillions. And so the scale of it all creates what is going to be an incredible market. So, John Street. Now let's move on to what is fascinating. I mean, I don't know how I have this take on crypto that's happening. We have this massive inflation on paper printing from COVID. And, you know, it's so easy for like Bitcoin people to come out and say it's a perfect case for Bitcoin. Gold bugs come out, it's a perfect case for gold, commodities, blah, blah, blah. But what happened during this COVID is the digital world exploded. And, you know, I'm starting to think about like people are bitching about inflation. I'm like, I don't think they understand how big inflation would be if there weren't these people blowing their brains out or having fun with NFTs. How connected are all these things?
Yeah, they're really connected. Last time I was on the podcast, I said QE turned your savings account into your checking account, the bond market into the savings account, the equity market into the bond market, the venture market into the equity market, and gave rise to the crypto market.
Right, and, right. And I now think crypto that, is here. That was a year ago, so you're right.
And I think that holds true. And for crypto to work, you need sort of the convergence of things to occur at both the macro and micro level. So at the macro level, if you look at cumulative central bank balance sheets from the Fed, ECB, BOJ, and PBOC, you know, that's over $30 trillion today. That was $19 trillion pre-COVID. So it's up $11 trillion in 18 months. It took 10 years to go up $11 trillion from 2007 to 2017, right? So you had the whole global financial crisis, you had the European debt crisis, and it took 11 years, and we did that in 18 months. So you have massive liquidity in the system. But the argument that people made prior to COVID was that inflation never manifested itself in headline core CPI, at least, because we didn't have the corresponding fiscal stimulus, one. And two, prior to the GFC, banks had limited excess reserves. So when the Fed started to expand its balance sheet, that went into excess reserves, was held by banks. They never lent it out. Today, bank balance sheets are strong, but personal balance sheets are also strong, right? If we look at personal debt service as a percentage of disposable income, we're at the lows since the 1980s, except for a brief period in the early 90s. Household debt to GDP is below where we were headed into the GFC. Savings rates are at all-time highs. So you have this convergence of factors on the macro front, which make it interesting. And then crypto itself has really caught the attention of a generation. You know, you have people that are entering the workforce today. Bitcoin, the network, launched in 2009. So they don't have an adult recollection without Bitcoin existing as a financial asset. And I think that's one thing that a lot of gold bugs miss here. Is that the clock's not going backwards as it pertains to that from a store value perspective. So people look at Bitcoin as a digital gold equivalent. People are looking at things like Ethereum and Solana as sort of the entree into whether it be DeFi, whether it be Web 3.0, whether it be NFTs. And there's
well,
real interest.
Because of Top Shot.
Yeah. Real interest in real assets. You know, there's $3 billion of NFT sales over the past 12 months. There's, you know, $80 billion of capital locked in DeFi right now. You can't, you know, argue with the size and scale of this. And it's really all manifested itself in the past 18 months.
But in the scope of $11 trillion, $4 billion is a fart. So it's still just. But what I think is happening is it's like this. It's like when you dump chemicals in the water back in the old days when we were suing DuPont and them. And basically these dollars are just being siphoned and cleaned in the digital world. Maybe they won't come back. And maybe, like I said, NFTs are the new Porsches. And what I mean there is, you know, when you were 40, it was a midlife crisis if you bought a Porsche and you hit it almost, right? Like it was, oh God, Howard got a Porsche. That means he's going to do this and he's going to do this and we should check on him. And now it's like 20-year-olds doing NFTs and there's no way they're telling their wives I spent $18 on an ape or whatever the fuck they call these things. But in a way where these kids are doing a service. Some people say, oh, I'd rather than buy Porsches. I kind of get that, but they're also keeping some of this inflation out of the system.
Yeah, you know, crypto's definitely not picked up in core CPI, that's for sure.
Yeah. And so are you bullish on crypto?
Yeah, I am bullish on crypto. If we take a look at where there's been real activity, I'd say there's been focus around DeFi, Web3, NFTs, and gaming. And DeFi, you know, if we think about the evolution of money or finance since banking was originated 5,000 years ago, it all comes down to how we pay, earn, save, spend, lend, borrow, invest, and insure. And that's about it. And DeFi has use cases across all of those. And when you use something like Saber in the Solana ecosystem, and you could seamlessly transfer assets from a decentralized exchange to a staking protocol and generate yield all using a Ledger wallet, never logging into a different website or front-end application, you could see the power of DeFi. But you also realize there are limitations to that. And I think the biggest structural limitations are we haven't found the right regulatory construct for that to operate. So I think it's experimental. It's really, really interesting. I think it's a long way to go until we can have that at institutional scale. It doesn't mean institutional participants aren't there. They are. You know, Jump Capital is incredibly active in the Solana ecosystem, as are a number of, you know, large funds throughout both, you know, Ethereum and Solana. I'd say those are sort of the two leading horses that pertains to DeFi activity. But to get the State Streets, the Bodies of the world, and the pensions and endowments there, I just think we're still a long ways off. Then you go to Web3. And, you know, Chris Dixon had a great Twitter thread on this yesterday where he said Web3 is to Web2, saying, you know, your take rate's my opportunity. So sort of tongue-in-cheek comparing to Bezos when he said your margin's my opportunity. And he highlighted Axie and crypto gaming, which has done $1 billion in sales, most of which has occurred over the past 3 months. And their take rate's 4.25% versus 100% for traditional games. So the players in that ecosystem get to keep the balance. He talks about NFT musicians keeping 90% of sales and social platforms like BitCloud, which you and I are both on, you know, get to participate in the take rate as opposed to 100% take rate from the Twitters and Facebooks of the world. So again, super interesting from an intellectual perspective, but still highly experimental because despite the economic alignment, the UI UX is still really poor for the most part here, and that needs to improve. And then we have NFTs. So whether it's Top Shot or CryptoPunks or Beeple Artwork, you know, $3 billion is $3 billion. And we could say it's recycled crypto wealth, but it's still recycled crypto wealth that people are spending on this. You mentioned Fred Wilson in one of your newsletter posts earlier this week. And he said, you know, NFT experiences are operating at the intersection of gaming, communities, and social networks. And I think that's spot on. And I think as we continue to bridge the gap between the digital and the real world or unique experiences, you're only going to see them rise in popularity. So a lot of interesting use cases, a lot of really, really smart people and human capital flooding the space and greater institutional capital. So definitely constructive.
Are you doing it? Have you bought... Or Don, have you guys bought something with a wallet?
Yeah, so I mean, big Bitcoin, Ethereum.
No, I meant like an NFT or a JPEG. Oh. Or...
Yeah, so I played around with Top Shot, right? I played around with CryptoPunks early on just to see what the commotion was about. I don't think any of those have sticking power, but also I have zero appreciation for traditional art. So it's not going to be for me. But I've spent a lot of time looking at the space, talking to people in the space, and I understand why it makes sense for some people.
Fred Wilson seems to think the killer app is coming. Why can't trading, lending, like what you said, just different form of money be the killer app? I still think that's still the killer app. Like, I mean, culture and community and Gary Vee and blah, 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 and, you know, I'm all for it. But I still think trading, holding, lending, insurance are the big things.
There's a reason why there's $80 billion locked in DeFi protocols, and there's only $3 billion of sales over the past 12 months for NFTs, right? So DeFi is definitely the killer blockchain app today, and I think that's tough to dispute. That's where the most of the developer activity is. That's where most of the financial capital is flowing into. But we haven't seen that NFT, you know, or you know, creative breakthrough yet, and maybe we will, maybe we won't. I think it goes back to what's the purpose of having a sovereign grade censorship resistant blockchain? And if that's not for money and finance, beyond that, there are benefits to centralization. So there's benefits that Facebook and Twitter have, you know, running in the cloud right now, as opposed to having to run distributed compute to power that. There's benefits to customer service, there's benefits for the regulators to point to somebody when they're doing something wrong. And I think that's the part that's missing for the Web3 vision of the world that's built on blockchain. I just don't know if it's purpose-built for that.
I'm with you. Don, go ahead.
John Street, I just have a quick question. You know, how worried do you think regulators are about the systemic risk of all of this? You know, with DeFi, they really can't see anything. You think they're totally freaked out at this point? And what do you think they do as far as regulation?
I think they're slowly but surely starting to get smarter on it. But if you look at the penalties that have come down out of the SEC and FINRA historically, they haven't even been slaps on the wrist. EOS, or Block One, which was the parent company of EOS, was fined $40 million for a $4 billion illegal security raise. That's cheaper than the placement agent fee they would have paid. You know, BitMEX was fined $100 million for running an illegal futures exchange. They made billions of dollars doing that. So I think we're early. I think they're exploring. I think why DeFi starts to scare them a little bit is the toll, not just that $80 billion that's locked in protocols, because I think for them, it's all Adult Swim for the most part. There's not a lot of mom and pops that are logging into MetaMask or Phantom wallets and distributing stable coins and yield farming. But I think when they see USDC have $28 billion and they don't know where those assets are sitting as it pertains to, you know, commercial paper investments or what banks they are, or if we look at Tether with $63 billion, which is probably more of a concern for them, I think that's where they start to focus. And I think that's where the regulatory pressure first starts to mount itself.
And that makes sense. I mean, that's just how governments work. Switching subjects quickly now, because we got a stance on crypto. So everything seems to be working. You know, oil's up. Economy's kind of opening. Airbnb just had numbers. The catastrophe never happened. The human catastrophe and the unintended consequence of people being locked up and birth rates and whatever, and medical and psychology, of course, 50 years, we won't know everything. But, you know, Goldman all-time highs. Crypto's bouncing off the May crash to near all-time highs in terms of total market cap, or maybe it's already passed it. And Apple right at all-time highs, Facebook at all-time highs. Nothing's not working. There's something for everybody. So in a world where there's something for everybody and everybody's bitching, is it that wall of worry that's working? Like, what do you think about at the firm? I know Don thinks about this every day and we chat about it every day, but what do you guys think about? It's like, okay, like I get it. Like I got to be long. But what are we missing? Like what stops this?
Yeah, it's a great question and sort of been the perennial question since the market bottomed last March. Mm-hmm. And we knew there was going to be this tsunami of fiscal and monetary stimulus that, you know, the capital markets never seen before. Mm-hmm. I think what surprised most market participants is A, how long that continued, and B, how well certain subsectors of the economy held up despite that. So if we look at the S&P right now, consensus EPS estimates for this year are $207 a share. So that means the S&P is trading at 21 and a half times this year's earnings and 20 and a half times next year consensus earnings. That's a 4.6% yield versus a 10-year at 1.35.
Right.
That's, you know, relatively attractive from an equity risk premium perspective. So it forces people into risk assets. It forces people out the curve. So Don mentioned the increase in capital and interest from crossover funds into venture. All of this is part of the same theme. I think you're forced into risk assets given this backdrop. What makes this stop? I think there's a couple of things. One, of course, is potential monetary policy error. But I think that the Fed is afraid of its own shadow here, so I don't think we'll see that. I think if anything, if you listen to the Druckenmillers of the world, who, you know, continue to ring the alarm bell, it's eventually this has to stop. And the longer we go on, the harder it is going to be able to take that potion that we need. And I think that's true in many regards. And then I think it's geopolitical. What happens with China? If we look at what's going on with Hong Kong and Taiwan, geopolitical risk is always underpriced because it's always a quote unquote black swan. But I think that that's a real risk here.
Yeah. Don, what do you, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think with the geopolitical risk, Howard, you and I talked about it a little bit last night over text. But you know, I think what's going to happen is the U.S. doesn't want these Chinese companies listed in the U.S. and the Chinese don't want them here. So you're going to see a lot of movement into the Hong Kong market, and mm-hmm. you know, then they'll begin to delist out of the U.S. I still think you know, if you look at the cycle of, you know, they went after Baba first and then obviously Didi, and you have companies like Key Holdings, which basically self-regulated themselves before earnings yesterday. You know, they think there's more risk there. Did Baba take the biggest slap on the wrist first to get it out of the way? And now they've worked with the Chinese government on Sunning. But yeah, I think it's definitely the geopolitical risk is a big overhang for the market.
Yeah. So I'm saying, like, for me, it still continues to be that people are misallocated. Like, the majority of people from this last bull run pre-COVID and now new is the 60-40 portfolio. I cannot believe how poorly allocated people are. And I don't think people understand that. Every financial advisor is stuck. They continue to stick their head in the ground and saying, well, you know, we're this and that, making excuses and they're not fiduciarily doing the right thing for their clients. Any thoughts there about, like, what can be done? And I'm super bullish on finding companies that to solve this problem already. Any thoughts on that, John Street?
I think that's right. I think there's still a really high allocation of capital to fixed income markets that has to move elsewhere, particularly at the retail financial advisor level. So if you look at the RIA industry in the US, it's about $10 trillion of investable assets. And that's a ton of capital that would need to find its way. And it has slowly found its way into the equity markets, which I think puts a consistent bid in each pullback. I think that needs to happen. I think people need to be more sophisticated about moving out the risk curve as it pertains to fixed income instruments. There's some interesting international corporate paper and sovereign paper that you could still get mid to high single digit yields on, which do have a place. And there's a bunch of ABS securities that, because of technology, can be brought to markets that have attractive yields. So I was just talking to a company prior to this that's doing some really interesting work in the auto space, and yields are 12-15%. You're getting tranche securities with really low default rates and risk. And that's yield that consumers previously didn't have access to. And the more companies can package that up into a solution that can give retail investors or RIAs access, I think we need to find other sources of yield too. But I think net, it's just a tailwind for the equity markets.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me because I'm conservative. You know, that's why I can't wait to give money to other people. It's like, I want to express it more, but it's just, I'm still like a high cash. It's so stupid how much cash or whatever conservative stuff I hold. Obviously, it's playing out in real estate. If I look at Zillow, Don and I talk about Zillow, is like, if you really take out all the vol, it was $40 before COVID, and it's $100 now. But in between, it was 20 and 200. So the markets are somewhat working. They're very sloppy in getting to where they go. And, you know, so it's like there is some self-correcting stuff trying to happen. People are behaving normal. And if we look at the SPAC market, we always said, like, eventually supply will just trump demand. And here we are with, you know, a lot of SPACs underperforming because there's just a lot of supply and there's not enough eyeballs and research and time for people to actually do the work, which leads to opportunity. Like, do you like stock picking?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anytime you start to see different parts of the market trade with a correlation of one, because of whether it be factor rotation, whether it be positioning, that's where there's usually opportunity to generate alpha. So it's been a really interesting market environment where, if you look at the index level, the S&P is just kind of ground up and to the right. It's up 18.5% year to date on minimal fall. The biggest pullback we've had is 4%. You know, it's one of the best risk-adjusted years of all time sitting here midway through August. But underneath the surface, there's been a ton of volatility. There's been some pretty significant factor rotations between high growth tech into small cap value, from long value into short growth, from reopening names versus stay-at-home names that have swung pretty significantly in a month-to-month basis, which has created a lot of opportunity. You mentioned the SPAC market, way too many sponsors chasing way too few deals. And now those names are all trading with a correlation of one. So you can look at a healthcare company one day, a two-sided payments network the next day, and a real estate company the third day. And they'll all trade with a correlation of one because their shareholder base is so similar, despite the fact that fundamentally they have very different drivers. And you have pipe investors who were chasing the froth in Q1 in February and March that are just getting unlocked, that are saying, get me out at any price, which is creating some interesting opportunities once those pipe shares are ultimately unlocked on the back end. So definitely looking at single stocks there. I think it's actually been one of the better single stock picking environments that we've seen in a number of years, you know, the back of last year and this year. Last time I was on the podcast, we talked about a bunch of these cloud stocks. And despite cloud stocks trading as if they were a meme, the market was doing an incredible job bifurcating between those with high net dollar retention and low net dollar retention. And similarly here, the market usually gets it right in the medium term, but in the short term, you can see some dislocations when you're trading with such high correlations.
Yeah, good take. Don, thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, the sector rotation has been fierce. I think a lot of the traders that I've been speaking to over the past few weeks, ever post the GameStop issue in January, have been having some issues trying to time the market and understand what's coming next. But yeah, I think that the markets are telling you one thing, the rotation's very tough to time. And you speak to more and more PMs out there, you know, they're telling you it's a buy the dip, the market's going higher, and we're going to continue to have some tailwinds.
Yeah, so now we covered two things and some macro. The crypto, we're consensusly got to be exposed. The financial markets, we kind of think you buy the dip and the rotation's been heavy and it's been a great year for indexing and it's hard to predict when this ends. So now let's move to some favorite topics. You know, for me, it's trading. John Street, Coinbase had their numbers. Robinhood's got their numbers coming up. You went through the Coinbase numbers. Like, how big is this market for Robinhood and Coinbase? This massive amount of people now trading and connected.
It's truly remarkable the size and scale of Coinbase for what most people view to be this sort of fringe industry. So Coinbase has 68 million verified users. That would be a top 20 country in the world. It would be right ahead of France and behind Germany. Now, only 8.8 million are monthly transacting users, but still, that's bigger than Interactive Broker or E-Trade and any brokerage firm, you know, not named Schwab or maybe Fidelity today from a user perspective. They saw $462 billion of trading volume in the quarter. They have $180 billion of assets on the platform. They did $2 billion in revenue and $1.6 billion in net income, which is really, really large. Now, I think...
Wait a minute. They have 80% again, net margins. That's bananas.
The market does a good job of getting this right in the sense that it's kind of looking through 2021 numbers, understanding, you know, where we might be at peak trading on peak crypto. So it's trading in line and actually at a slight discount to the incumbent exchanges. So if you look at Coinbase on a growth adjusted basis or even on a non-growth adjusted basis versus NASDAQ versus New York Stock Exchange versus Tradeweb versus MarketAxess, right now it's trading at 18 and a half times consensus 21 EBITDA and 25 times consensus 22 EBITDA versus those peers at 26 and 23. So it looks cheap if you factor in growth. It looks really cheap if you think they could actually grow from this space and they don't decelerate next year. But the size and scale is truly, truly impressive. What I thought was most interesting about Coinbase numbers was if you look at the breakdown between retail and institutional volume, you know, retail's 30% of the volume, institutional 68%, but retail's 95% of the revenue and institutional's 5%. So that's the bear thesis, is that as institutions continue to become a greater percentage of the volume, the blended take rate on institutional traders is 3 basis points, while the blended take rate on retail is 130 basis points. So that's the bear thesis there. But what I thought was most interesting was that Bitcoin and Ethereum were 50% of the volume in the quarter. So that meant $230 billion of crazy other crypto, not named Bitcoin and Ethereum, was traded. I was just wondering what these institutions are punting around in, but it's great.
But I think it could be retail. And so an unstoppable force, an incredible company. On the other side, on the stock side, with a little bit of crypto, is Robinhood. I'm biased. Give me your take of the whole process, how young people should think about Citadel and payment for order flow. Just give me your hot takes.
I think I'll start with payment for order flow just because I believe that that's, you know, fundamentally misunderstood. I think everyone's, you know, the view that, oh, Citadel's front-running me or Virtu's front-running me. But in actuality, there's a couple of ways in which Robinhood could execute a transaction on your behalf. They could internalize it where they're actually taking the other side of the trade from you, or they could exhaust it to the street, which is effectively what happens with PFOF. And because Citadel and Virtu and Wolverine are the best traders in the world with the most high frequency trading execution speeds, they can offer best pricing. So if you were to go out and try and execute Apple and send it to an exchange and get a price back, you're going to get a worse fill than if you send it to Citadel. And that's part of their business, is aggregating retail flow to offset that against institutional supply and vice versa. So I think there's a lot to do about nothing here. I think if the regulators actually spent the time and focused in on this, they'd realize that either retail investors would be charged more, because you're talking about fractions of pennies that these traders or that these trading firms are making on this versus the $8 or $30 back in the day that the brokerage used to charge you for trading. So you can't say this hasn't been a net positive for end users at the end of the day. And if you look at the actual PFOF disclosures that Robinhood files, you could see the vast majority of it comes in option trading. So if you're executing an S&P 500 stock year to date, so through the first 6 months of the year, because they just updated their 2Q report, they've made $10 million from PFOF for S&P 500 stocks, yeah, which is the vast majority of what people are doing.
The charity business.
Yeah. They've made $175 million from non-S&P 500 stocks, and they've made $360 million from options. But there's no way to execute an options trade without routing to a firm like this for retail investors. So you're going to have much worse pricing if this were to ever go away. So I think those risks are overblown and a bit coming out of, you know, people who don't really understand market microstructure.
But this is my point. No one's even trying to explain this to you.
Yeah.
Like, there's nobody on CNBC and Bloomberg even. They're supposed to just explain to a new, you know, you are the product. Yes, they're the product, but it's even less evil than you think. Like, they're providing a service that, anyways, well, I appreciate the explanation there. Don, same take?
Yeah, I think John Street's spot on with it. I mean, it's just shocking to me the amount of hate that you get from people just because of what the media puts out there. I mean, you hear it more than anyone, but people put their own two cents into what Robinhood and these other platforms are doing without really understanding the backstory of how the system works and how much money it saved them in commissions over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think what people are remembering is that the companies being disrupted, and they're not fully disrupted, Schwab's $100 billion, had every chance to do this. They could have taken out the $8 last mile, but they had a bunch of people on staff that were protecting their jobs, not creating the product that Robinhood became. Because they said, don't worry, in their quarterly reports, they said, don't worry, we could build that in an hour, all to protect their jobs. This is how incumbents lose power.
Especially in a world where your data is being sent to a gazillion places and you have no idea where it is. I mean, I must get 300 spam phone calls a day from Nigeria and other countries. It's just crazy how people don't think this through.
Yeah, good point. And so what's interesting to me is that we're missing the conversation, which is, 100 million new PFOF, if you discount Coinbase, Robinhood just got downloaded onto the best game in the world, the market. And instead of being excited about that, we're bitching about it. And the people that are onboarded by these companies are bitching about it. Let's explain Citadel quickly, and then I'll let you go, John Street, and riff on this. How is Google different than Citadel? Google's order flow for every word on the internet, is it not? Am I getting that wrong? Like, Google is Citadel.
For sure.
I mean, in some way, you know what I mean? Not you know, it's packaging, but you're buying a word, they're selling the word, they're bidding it out, someone's paying up for the word, you know what I mean? And we don't even have any regulation of what we're paying, like on Facebook and Google. They're Citadel at like 100 times the scale.
To put some numbers around it, the way in which the brokerage industry measures activity, it starts daily average revenue trades. And if we look at 2020 numbers for Robinhood, they had 83 darts per account per year. That means the average user traded 83 times a year, which is quite active.
Yeah.
If we use the old $8 model, that's $664 that users would have paid for trading commissions. The average account size was $5,000. Yeah, it's 13% that they would have been paying in commissions.
Right.
On those 83 trades, they're paying less than $83 now. So you're talking about a significant cost savings for the user, despite the fact that, yes, Citadel's making mills on a per trade basis.
And what I tell people when I do that math for them is take that $500 and go get a mentor. Go pay $50 a month for someone to help you invest. And now you win. It's just people aren't doing the math. And young people aren't doing the math. and they're picking the bogeyman, and they're doing it without listening to Fox News and CNBC, which is what's really startling. So I don't know. Is it Reddit? Like, where are they getting the hate from, do you think?
I think everyone wants to have a villain to point to, right, when things don't go well. And the talking heads on CNBC and the like to dramatize different topics. And PFOF is an easy topic because Robinhood went out there and they said their mission was to democratize access to finance. And they're not completely without fault, right?
Well, saying you're going to democratize this is like, you know, that's part of the problem. They have democratized it, so shut up. Saying you're an immigrant, well, fucking half the country's an immigrant. Shut up. Like, I get that stuff. There's bad PR there. And I also get the fact that they haven't properly explained what happened that day because maybe they can't. If you were CEO that day, so what do you think happened and what do you think would be the right way to have handled it?
I think what they could have done better is they could have explained the why, mm-hmm. as it pertains to why they had to shut down accounts. And I think that they could have mentioned the capital call. And obviously, you know,
because that's what it was, a run on the bank. No, it was just there was a hole in the system.
It wasn't even a run on the bank as much as it was a run on the fact that they didn't have the intraday collateral to settle, right? Because we still settle T plus two. So I think what the GME and AMC saga showed us is the potential issues with T plus two settlement for equities. Now, a lot of funds like that, because there's inherent leverage for them in the system when they get to wait 2 days to settle funds, right? We could do real day settlement, but people won't do that. But this gets into a lot of detail around clearing and DTCC and what the actual plumbing of financial markets looks like. And I think that Robinhood probably didn't feel the need to justify that to their end users. But they ultimately did when Vlad had to testify in front of Congress. And they showed out a timeline where they said that, you know, the week of January 25th, their obligation was $124 million. And the VIX spiked 62% that day, which was the third largest daily gain since 1990. So you're talking about, that, an eight sigma event. And on the 28th, they told them, the NSCC said, you guys have a deficit of $3 billion, $1.3 billion of which was VAR based. And they had to go and try and find $3 billion of capital. Then as the day went on, they had another excess capital premium charge, and the NSCC said, you owe $3.7 billion versus the $700 million that was held there. So they had to go and raise that, and the folks at Ribbit and the likes, you know, funded that capital within 24 hours, which was, you know, told you something about what insiders thought of the business. And I think that the big fault that they had was not having the observation systems in place to see that they were going to bump up against collateral requirements in certain names. And I think also it shows sort of the difficulty of self-clearing. They moved off Apex a couple of years ago to become self-clearing. And I think that it's something that you really need people that have done this before doing it. It's not something you can kind of build from scratch nine times out of 10. And this is the result. But they learned their lesson, and they have adults there now that are overseeing this business.
Right. Like, I mean, that's a great take. Don, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the other thing to the whole GME AMC saga back in January was...
It still continues. What do you mean? It's ongoing.
Well, the retail community doesn't understand that a lot of institutions, their prime brokers, weren't allowing them to trade these names as well. So, you know, I know that Jefferies and Goldman and a few other places wouldn't take the trades through their pipe. So you had to go out and do layoff trades to other brokers. They would clear the trade on your end, but they weren't going to take the execution of it. So they weren't allowing institutions to either, you know, trade the equity or trade the options through their pipes, through their prime brokerage, where, you know, that story was never told. Everyone, you know, the only thing people saw that they thought the retail community was being attacked and that Robinhood was shutting them down from their capital. So it's pretty interesting to hear two sides of the story, too.
Yeah, so far I only understand one, because you're supposed to have two brokerage accounts. Like XIV, I blew up and I'm a veteran. Like, fucking markets will kill you. It's the old Dead Sea thing. You got to cut. The salt will find the wound. Like I said, what would you have said, John Street? Like, you know, obviously buck stops with Vlad. That's why people hate him. I can't believe what Barstool got away with and some of these other people got away with saying, you know, get with the conflicts that they have and, you know, running gambling sites. But that's media. You know, he's a young guy. he got bad advice, and whether it was finally his decision, we'll never know. But like, even the VC should be saying, guys, just explain what happened. We're bullish. We put up $4 billion. There's a hole in the system caused by everybody clicking the same green button at the same time, and it was all fun and games, and the bank almost imploded. But good news, our VCs really think this is an incredible business, and here's the money you're saving by doing PFOF, and they're still not explaining it. Or do you just move on and you just can't stop? You can't explain this to people.
I think it's really nuanced, and people don't want to hear the explanation. People want to say they lost all this money.
Yeah.
And that was that. But of course, what they don't mention is, you know, the buy button was turned off, but the sell button, you know, remained on for a period of time. And you could have sold, which, you know, is where you really, quote unquote, lost money. So I don't know. I think had they taken the approach that they did in front of DC and just laid things out factually, this is what happened. But you understand the PR team is probably saying, oh, we can't, because then we'll be concerned that we'll see a real run on the bank. And if we tell people there are some liquidity issues, they're all going to pull their money at the same time. And the money's all not there. But that's to no fault of Robinhood's. That's just the way that the clearance system works.
All right. So now we've got a take on the brokerages. I think they're all done. I think Schwab's done. I think they're done. I think Robinhood coming up with this distributed semi-direct IPO was risky and genius and wow, bravo, because they took so much brand risk with already being in trouble with users and the media, and they're not getting any credit for it. So I guess, you know, it's a tough one because this IPO crushed it considering what they had to go up against. Do you think it was a good idea to do what they did? Does that change anything?
I think it's completely orthogonal to the vision that they laid out. So I think it makes a ton of sense. If you can truly democratize access to IPO shares to retail investors, bravo. And I think that if you could show that they're long-term holders and they're not flipping day one like most hedge funds do, you'll actually continue to get that product from other companies. So I think that worked out. I think what the entire street's trying to figure out is how that manifests itself in ultimate trading dynamics. So you saw much lower hedge fund participation in the Robinhood IPO.
For the first 4 days, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just in terms of like the IPO book, if you talk to the underwriters, you didn't see the hedge funds that are there in every IPO. And a lot of them, you know, whether it was price, whether it was PFOF concerns, or whether they were just concerned about the trading dynamics, they didn't know what that would mean to have that many retail investors. And I think more or less, you know, it wasn't any different than a traditional IPO. So as long as that continues to happen, you'll see a couple of companies that'll probably have similar ethos look to go down that path. I think they could very well become part of the distribution of those syndicate books going forward.
All right, Don?
No, I think what they've done is genius. You know, for years and years, the game for IPOs has been, you know, pay the banks a lot of money, churn a lot of stock, and get your allocation and flip out.
Right, that was payment forward or flow in its own right.
And no one scrutinized that business, and it made a lot of people rich, and you still see it to this day. And if you got plugged on one IPO, you know, the banks made it up to you on the next one and over allocated you. And you know, the same thing you and I talked going into the Robinhood IPO. And I said to you, I think, you know, it's only 2 to 3x oversubscribed. Historically, a deal like this, you know, would look 20x oversubscribed. And you saw a lot of the institutions steer away from it. But I think, you know, Goldman did a pretty good job directing it. They got some sovereign wealths involved outside of your traditional hedge funds. And I think that Robinhood's definitely disrupting the business and that product's here to stay.
So now that everybody's onboarded, and we've now discussed these three things and the fact that everybody's onboarded, would you rather be a trader or a VC, John Street?
Well, I don't think you have to choose. I think
good
you
point.
Can be both.
I know you don't, but like what interests you if you had to like do one?
I think trading as a profession is very difficult versus investing, right? I'm going to delineate between the two because when you trade today, the market, the public equity market has been bifurcated to two camps, passive and quant. And when you're trying to trade as a human, you're going up against the most sophisticated computer trading algorithms that exist in the world. And that's just a losing proposition 9 times out of 10. Now, if you're investing and you have a time arbitrage, as any individual investor does, because you have no capital calls that are going to be made, you have no time discretion, you have no investment hurdles that you have to hit, and you can take a long-term view, I think you can outperform. So I think investing in public equities is great. I think everybody should do it with whatever discretionary income that they have left over after, you know, taking care of their core obligations. And I think being a venture investor is full of opportunity. I think if you think about who can outperform VCs or public hedge funds over the next decade from here, I think VCs still have a slight advantage because there's a finite valuation at which a seed round can get done at, or a Series A round can get done at. And while there are always exceptions to that, even though valuations have risen across the board, you haven't seen seed or Series A valuations increase proportionately with what the market's done over the past 10 years. So what you've had happen is exit opportunities have been larger. Entry points have an increase at the same point. So actually, if you look at like the 2015 to 2020 vintage VC funds that started, those are some of the top IRRs of any VC funds that have existed. And that's because of that macro environment. Now, some people can argue, oh, it's a perfect storm. Real rates aren't going to be negative for the foreseeable future. And you're not going to have this once in a generation monetary and fiscal stimulus occur concurrently. So it was a perfect exit opportunity and everybody's exiting. And that's actually the dumb money taking on the other side. But I think VC funds have an inherent advantage there, and they have a structural advantage. Everybody makes fun of Tiger for coming into these rounds and outbidding folks. But what they don't realize is they're sitting at top of the liquidation preference. So, you know, if Tiger says, here's $250 million at a $2 billion valuation, and that company gets sold for $500 million, guess what? Their money good.
Yeah,
so that's my biggest worry. Is, than everybody else.
That's my biggest worry is to see it. I want to have a. I called it a SoftBank spooge clause, and I wanted to make founders sign it. And the one thing that I could not have predicted, because forgetting about predicting crashes, and Don and I talk about this stuff every day, is I could not have predicted the crash in SoftBank leading to 10 SoftBanks. But obviously, with the Fed, I mean, maybe I should have thought that. But like, I literally thought, oh, God, thank God WeWork wasn't public, or else the public markets would have crashed, and that'll end that. And I knew it was coming because of their WAG investment, which I was in. I was like, what? I was shaking my head. The company's 2 years old. They raised $300 million. But you get a good lesson in cap table of why they can't lose and the other people lose, because they have almost no risk, like Andreessen does. They put in their $200 million to $2 billion. They can pull that $200 million out. It may not be good IRR, but they're not as at risk as everybody else who's jammed down the cap table now. All right. Well, great stuff. I want to end it with my favorite topic, and you've covered this well, and we talked about it on the first podcast about a year ago, Twitter Square, run by the same human person. And I just think it's infuriating but fun to be corp dev armchair here as they make mistake after mistake but grow. When we chatted last, John Street, we talked about how it would make total sense for Square to buy Twitter. What's happened since? You know, it's been a year. Both stocks have gone up, but like, what's your take? Because a lot of changes.
Yeah, absolutely. So my whole thesis on this has been Square, I think, out of all the fintech companies, is best positioned to create a global closed-loop payment system. And that's sort of the holy grail, and that's how you can compete with Visa, MasterCard. And why Twitter, I thought, was an interesting acquisition target for them is because Twitter has a significantly large ex-US presence. So they have 206 million users, but 140 million of them are ex-US. So that's really complementary with Cash App, 70 million users, the vast majority of whom are in the US.
Correct.
But ultimately what happened last week was Square acquired Afterpay for $29 billion. This was done at 35 times this year's gross profit, call it 23 times next year's gross profit versus Square trading at like 20 and 16 times. So slightly diluted from a multiple perspective. What it gave them access to was Afterpay has 16 million users and 100,000 merchants globally. And that might not seem like a lot because Cash App has 70 million users and millions of merchants globally. But one was the international footprint, which was important. And the second is Afterpay is a buy now, pay later company. That also has a really good referral flywheel for their merchants. So out of those 16 million users, they're able to send their merchants a million users per day, which I think Square was particularly attracted to. So Square thought they had the ability to move upstream and attract some of these Afterpay enterprise merchants, which they haven't historically had a good track record attracting. And they clearly thought buy now, pay later is here to stay. The bears will say PayPal built a pay in four solution internally, and within 2 quarters of it being live, they did $1.5 billion in TPV in 2Q alone. And they have 650,000 merchants using the platform and 7 million consumers used it 20 million times. So why can't Square just pay for this? And I think that's a question that Jack's going to have to answer over the next 3 to 4 years. You know, does Afterpay successfully integrate the Cash App and Seller ecosystem the way they think it would? Or would something like Twitter have been more attractive at this point in time? Because, you know, while Twitter would have been more expensive in terms of total enterprise value, it would have been a lot more accretive as it pertains to gross profit, a lot more accretive as it pertains to EBITDA. You know, Twitter's going to do $4 billion in EBITDA next year. Square is going to do $1.3 billion. But they wouldn't have had any merchant integration. So, you know, this definitely puts that off the table for a minimum of 2 years. But you can just see the way Jack's talking about both companies. The product roadmaps are converging. He's talking about integrating Lightning Network into Twitter and integrating social features into Square. And he has such a powerful social media platform in Twitter. I don't know why they would try and build anything at Square from the bottom up, but such is the way he's thinking right now.
Don?
No, I mean, I agree with John Street's thesis through and through. You know, if you look at what Square paid for Afterpay, you know, was it the right multiple, the right price? Is the integration going to be seamless? And, you know, kind of think through what's going on now. You and I see it on a daily basis with early fintech valuations. But, you know, what point is it, buy versus build, and how does an executive make that decision?
Yeah, I mean, Johnston, that's what we'll end with what Don's saying. It's like, so did that get them to where you want to go? I mean, it's not what you and I would like to see, because he's running two companies that could be doing the same thing, and everybody, you know, let him blow one, not two. Because if he blows it in the end, I feel like Twitter's, I don't know why, I feel Twitter's got a bigger moat than Square at some level. Like, I don't know, I've never seen Square Cash in the wild, and people are buying, I just don't get it. But I mean, obviously I'm wrong. It feels like there's so much competition at, like, from Toast to all, I just don't get Square, and I've been wrong the whole way. So do you own Square?
I do own Square. I wouldn't add to Square at these levels. I think it's pretty significantly overvalued here. Part of it is just entry point. Part of it is, you know, as a fintech investor, if you think they can acquire themselves into this global payment network, then it's, you know, worth multiples of this. And I think if they do strategic M&A in different geographic regions, I would have loved to see some tuck-in M&A in Africa, Southeast Asia, or in Latin America, as opposed to Afterpay, which is predominantly Australia, a little bit of Europe, and a little bit of the US. But, you know, Afterpay was a first mover in the buy now, pay later space. And a lot of the call, Jack was praising the qualitative aspects of the team. Now, no team's worth $29 billion. So again, I just think they probably overpaid for it. But we'll see over the next 3 to 4 years.
All right. So we'll check in on that in 6 months. We got to not do it every year. We'll do it every 6 months. But we went through everything. I'm going to, John Street, I know you're busy. Thanks for checking in here. Enjoy the rest of the summer, and I'll see you in person soon.
Really appreciate it, guys. Have a good one. Enjoy the rest of the summer.
Thanks.
Have a good one.
Take care.
We're letting John Street out. Don, let's wrap up. What we're thinking here is, like, I think he's long Twitter too. Like, is it something that you see? Like, you were on the trade desk, like a big hedge fund. Like, what have I missed on Square? What's working?
You know, I think the thing with Square is, how big is this? How much of it really came from what's happened with Cash App? You know, it's clearly driven their numbers much higher than most people expected, right? Because a lot of people were offsides in that trade post-COVID. They thought that Square was going to get crushed, people who didn't understand the business.
I remember trading at 40 and I was short it for a few days, just laughing.
People thought, oh, this business has a ton of, you know, exposure to SMB. They're going out of business right now. Every small business is shut. The POS isn't going to work. But, you know, obviously they did a really great job executing on Cash App and other facets of the business. You know, what kind of I think through is, as these companies begin to grow, what happens in the regulatory environment, right? And we talk about this all the time, that, you know, fintech right now is, it's fast and loose. And, you know, John Street touched on it as well. You know, build, build, build. We'll worry about the fines later because we don't think that they're going to be that big, where the banks, you know, Dodd-Frank and whatnot are extremely heavily regulated. So, you know, what point does regulation step in here and take the wind out of the sails in some of these companies, and to what extent do they do it?
Yep. Well, there you have it. We'll keep coming at you. This was John Street and Don Nitti. Don on our team, John Street in the VC hedge fund world as well. This Panic with Friends. We talk to investors, traders, entrepreneurs, founders, trying to get a couple steps ahead of the market. Tune in weekly. Hit the subscribe button. You won't have to think about it. Apple, Spotify, Google. Just search my name, Howard Lindzen, or Panic with Friends, and we'll come at you every Thursday. Have a good day, everybody.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.